Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Hi, Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience, also proprietor of the Princeton Election Consortium and the Princeton Gerrymandering Project.
So, Sam, here we are recording on Wednesday, the day after the election, an election we've been talking about for a while. It was a big election day. Many Democrats are feeling quite pleased with the fact that they will now control the House of Representatives, which is a big shift in political power in Washington. The party also performed well in many state gubernatorial elections and legislative races, and also just enjoyed an impressive new group of candidates who are changing the face and tenor of the party. Some observers believe that the anti-Trump coalition showed up and showed that it could produce results. On the other hand, some Republicans are pleased with the outcome, even though they lost the House. They're pointing to the fact that their majority expanded in the Senate and that they will still be able to control judicial nominations, check the House on legislation and investigation. So the morning after, everyone is claiming victory. And of course, to be expected, the president feels that he has been vindicated. We are honored and very pleased to discuss today with Valerie Jarrett the election and everything that happened. She is the former senior advisor to President Barack Obama and the former chair of the White House Council on Women and Girls. Currently, she serves as a senior advisor to the Obama Foundation and president of the board of When We All Vote, a nonpartisan, not-for-profit focused on voter registration. As the longest-serving senior advisor to President Obama, she oversaw the offices of public engagement and intergovernmental affairs and chaired the White House Council on Women and Girls. She led the Obama administration's efforts to expand and strengthen access to the middle class and to boost American business and the economy. And she oversaw a number of important policy issues, including how to empower working families through equal pay, raising the minimum wage, paid leave, paid sick days, workplace flexibility, affordable child care, and much more. She has an extensive background before that in the public and private sectors. And we are really, again, just delighted to have you here. So welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, Julian. And Sam, I'm delighted to be with you today. Auspicious occasion.
Yes, a big day.
And a historic day, given the nature of what we've seen in this presidency. Maybe we can just start with what are some of your impressions about how the Democratic Party performed yesterday and what they should be most excited about with the outcome?
Well, I think they performed very well. I think wrestling control of the House, which it was a huge accomplishment, I think it provides the ability to have a check and balance where there has been none with both houses and the White House controlled by the same party. So I think that's a big win. There were also some painful defeats. I was just in Florida over the weekend campaigning with Andrew Gillum and his wife, and it felt energized on the ground, and that was a big disappointment. I know Stacey Abrams, at least as far as I know, is yet to concede a very close race, but she's right now a bit behind. And Beto O'Rourke, obviously, in Texas, who outperformed a lot of what was expected months ago and had a groundswell of national attention and resources, but it was a close race there too. So overall, I would say the Democrats did what they set out to do, which was to communicate a message that would resonate broadly across the country in sufficient numbers to, most importantly, win back the House.
And do you have a sense of, and there might not be, the types of candidates who seem to perform best or who were able to really rally Democrats and deliver the vote? Is there a type in terms of looking ahead, or is it more complex and diverse than that?
I think it's more complex. I will say across the board, and this includes the governors who won as well, I think people don't want to just vote against something. They want to vote for something. And those who were able to, in a compelling way, communicate a message that was positive, that was one of unifying, that was one of appreciating what we have in common. Those are kind of the central tenets of the Democratic Party, and I think they resonated. That isn't always enough to get you over the finish line, and there are a host of reasons for why that's the case. I mean, the two states we started out talking about, conservative, traditionally Republican states with large rural areas that almost always vote Republican, that's a headwind. But I suppose the silverest lining for me is the record turnout in a midterm. We all know that traditionally midterm elections are ignored by a large segment of our population, and that this year the fact that we saw a record number of people turn out, we saw a record number of women elected, people of color elected. You now have a first-time gay governor of Colorado. You have a Muslim American in Minnesota. Things are changing in terms of the diversity of the representation. Not nearly where I would want it to be, but certainly going in the right direction.
Big step.
Big step.
And I have to ask, what did you think of how former President Barack Obama contributed to the campaigns in the final weeks? He was really out there, and he was making some pretty poignant remarks. What was your evaluation of what role that played in all of this?
I think it was an important factor. That's why so many of the candidates were enthusiastic about having him come to their hometowns and campaign with them. He cares passionately about our country. He has been very reserved over the last couple of years to give his successor spaces, has been the tradition of most presidents once they leave office. He has reserved his comments to, as he said he would before he left office, moments when the core values of our country are being challenged. So whether it was the repeal of the Affordable Care Act or walking away from the climate accord, where every other nation in the world practically signed on, or walking away from the deal that prevented Iran from developing nuclear weapons, or the separation of families at the border. So critical times where he thought much was at stake, he has spoken out. But he has been mostly reserved. And I think at this point, with the accumulation of events of the last couple of years, he concluded that this was the most important election of his lifetime, and therefore imperative that he use his voice, his platform, his popularity to try to push the needle wherever he could.
Now, talking about the election, and it seems like people almost saw two different campaigns. You just described the view of many that this is a pivotal time in U.S. history, something huge happened 2 years ago, and we found out a little bit about whether things are going to go in the same direction or whether, as you say, there'll be a check on power. But it almost seemed like there were two campaigns going on. Naively, one might imagine Gillum, Abrams, O'Rourke all represent something that I think is really inspiring to progressives and inspiring to Democrats. Yet it seemed like there was this whole other campaign, and the tone was led by Trump, where the tone is one of wanting to restrict the vote in the case of Brian Kemp, going on the attack in ways, even in his victory speech, Cruz was not, to a naive ear, not terribly gracious to O'Rourke. And so I'm just curious if you had some sense of what it looks like to you when you look at the side that won those close races. What does that feel like?
Well, I think the tactic that was employed is a page out of the old political handbook of fear-mongering 101. It's a powerful tool, and we've seen candidates certainly in the past defeated as a result of its implementation. Over the long term, I think the message of hope and change and inspiration and appealing to what is good in all of us wins out. I think you have to be prepared to take the long view. I mean, I wouldn't, if I were an advisor to Beto or Andrew or Stacey, I would not have advised them to do anything other than they did. They were themselves. They were authentic. They had a compelling message. And the fact that they didn't win doesn't mean that they should have done something different than what they did. It just means that our work is not over. And I was heartened last night to hear Andrew's concession speech, where he made it clear this was never about him and that the journey will continue and that he will be a part of that journey. And I think that's the attitude that is often missing. Particularly, I worry about young people who are so used to instant gratification. And many of the folks who were here on campus today grew up with President Obama in office, and they saw two successful campaigns that their parents or their siblings or even they participated in, and he made it look easy. And it's never easy. Wrestling power away from those who have it is always hard, and it often doesn't materialize in one election cycle, which is why we have to be resilient and take the long view.
Well, it's really striking that in the case of these three very narrowly fought races, that there is something stylistically similar about these three candidates, Gillum, Abrams, O'Rourke, where they all took the high road. They all took what to an observer might look like an Obama-esque approach to really showing people what public service can be. But I wanted to ask you about voting rights, and so an area that you've become very involved in. These are also three cases where these were closely fought elections, especially Florida and Georgia. And we've had talk of hundreds of thousands of voter registrations either erased or in question in Georgia. Florida is a place where there can be problems with voter identification. I wanted to get a sense from you about the role of, I don't know, on the one hand, turnout, but also voting rights. Like, how hard is it to get people to vote? I mean, it seems like turnout played a huge role, even as high as the turnout was.
Well, let me take a step back, Sam, and say this. First of all, I think that those of us who no doubt were caught up in the energy of their campaigns might forget that those were always uphill battles. Those are traditionally deeply red states. And here you had unconventional candidates who captured the hearts of the nation, but faced the realities on the ground. And the fact that those three races were as close as they were is a signal of enormous progress. I think the point that you make about voter suppression, whether there are laws or practices, is very real in our country, and we have to do something about it. It is cowardly to me that people in positions of power would try to suppress the vote. Why not just compete on your ideals and your values and your vision? Why do you feel the need to try to keep other people from voting? Texas is a stark example where you can use your license to carry a firearm to register to vote, but not your student identification. It's clearly skewed to try to repress students who tend to be more progressive to participate. And in the case of Georgia, Stacey had to go against her opponent, who was the Secretary of State, who passed the law that required the exact name to match up. And again, a tactic to try to suppress the vote.
In that case, hundreds of thousands.
In that case, hundreds
possibly.
Of thousands. She was successful in two court cases. And so in that sense, the legal system worked as it should. But we should not, you are right, Sam, to highlight a insidious problem that we have in our country of voter suppression. And some of it is more subtle. I remember in 2012, I went to Florida in the early vote period to encourage people to stand in these long lines and vote for President Obama. And the lines were circling the buildings, and in part because there had been added all of these ballot initiatives. So it took a half an hour for everybody to vote. Again, a little bit more subtle, but intended to suppress the vote, I believe. So we have to be transparent and open about what's going on, and we have to be vigilant to try to fight it. And I think that work is ongoing, and everyone from the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights and the Law to individual people who feel empowered to raise their hand and say, I tried to vote and I was shooed away because of a ballot that wasn't exactly, a name check that wasn't exactly right. Everybody needs to feel empowered to combat this insidious practice.
Well, we're all focused on these top line marquee races where we're really focused on individual candidates. But on the topic of voter rights, there are some very big and I think positive things that happened last night. I think of re-enfranchising former felons who have served
Florida,
their time.
That was a big deal.
Right? I mean, this is for things like having a fake ID. That's apparently a felony in Florida. And so 1.5 million people who didn't commit murder, didn't commit sexual assault, they served their time. 1.5 million people re-enfranchised there. Automatic voter registration passed in Michigan and I believe same-day election registration in Maryland. So there are some pretty big positive steps in voting rights that happened last night that, you know, that we didn't see them on our television until like 1 a.m. because they weren't, you know, Beto O'Rourke yelling at a rally or what have you.
But those are very important.
But those seem really consequential. So
very important.
You know, where do you see that?
Well, one thing I'd say about Florida is part of how that happened was it wasn't just a progressive agenda. You had conservative Republicans who also believed in redemption and second chances. I was texting with the general counsel of Koch Industries, who is
right.
a
they
big
were in
proponent
favor. Right.
of criminal justice reform and specifically this measure, and had been actively campaigning for it. And so I think it showed that when you can find common ground between sides that are traditionally ideologically apart, that's when progress gets made. And it was really heartening to see people appreciate the importance of making voting easy and accessible. If you ask the average voter, they all want early vote. They all want to be able to use technology as a tool, and we should debunk the absolutely unfounded contention that there is widespread vote fraud in this country. There simply is no evidence of it. And so to try to develop laws that are ostensibly to keep vote fraud from happening are really just simply another tactic to suppress the vote.
I mean, that's 1 out of 10 Floridians who just got reenfranchised, right? 1.5 million. It's a huge number.
It's
really
a
impressive.
Huge number. Yes, it is. And hopefully will be a template for the remaining states that have such egregious laws.
So then there is the other part of the election, which probably most Democrats won't be as pleased about, and that's the Senate. And not only did the Republicans keep their majority, they expanded their majority. And also they did that after 1 month, as you said, of a really blistering campaign tour by the president, where at least in my mind, he was directly playing to the politics of white backlash. And the outcome in the upper chamber for Democrats are both in terms of actual power problematic, in that the Senate can obviously continue with judicial confirmations and check the House in terms of legislation or investigation, but also just what it means about the electorate in some of the states, that these arguments, not hope and optimism, rather fear and hatred, seem to have resonated and seem to have been a tactic that did work in preserving that bastion of power. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, Julian, first of all, the facts bear out that that's true, but I think we have to recognize that we always had a tough map. We knew in the Senate the seats that were up were the most vulnerable, the ones where we had Democrats like Claire McCaskill in an extremely increasingly red state. So we expected that it was going to be a tough battle and hoped that the message that we were delivering would be one that would resonate over those obstacles, those clear, inherent, traditional obstacles. And that was not the case. But I think we can't afford to read too much into that, and we certainly shouldn't change our message and start to appeal to the baser nature of people. That, to me, doesn't represent the core ideals of the Democratic Party. And so I don't believe, I mean, I believe we double down and we try harder, and that ultimately these elections turn on turnout. That's, you know, all the campaigning and all the money boils down to one thing, and that is, do you inspire people to actually show up at the polls? And do you try to make it as easy for them to vote? I give you one example. In the 2016 election, statistics showed that 15 million people didn't vote because they didn't have access to transportation. Well, in this election, one of the things that my not-for-profit organization did was partner with Lyft and other organizations to try to make transportation to the polls affordable. So we have to look at what are the barriers, the systemic barriers that get in the way of people voting, so that when we trigger turnout, people can actually have the ability to show up and vote. Early vote is a big piece of that, and I don't understand why every state doesn't have every vote. Every state should have same-day registration. Every state should use technology more effectively to make voting easier. And I think those are the kinds of initiatives that will ultimately better reflect intent and desire translated into voting.
And so let me just follow up on that. So clearly a big part of this is turnout, and the kinds of procedural or mechanical initiatives that you're doing, whatever you want to call them, are hugely important. But what's your take on what resonates in the red states with President Trump? Meaning, the map was always bad, but he is, some would say, so unconventional, so off center, that some were hoping or expecting there still might be, a blue wave in the Senate. You've been in the White House, you've seen the electorate. What's your take on what is the attraction. Is it partisan? Is it him? Is it to his arguments? What makes those places deeply red?
I have no idea. I honestly, I think about it and it just upsets me so much. I try not to dwell. I don't know why his appealing to the baseness and fear-mongering is so effective with them. I suppose people who are feeling vulnerable are easier to scare. People who feel that change might threaten the status quo that they've come to know and appreciate, cling to that status quo, and yet he's this unconventional candidate. So there's obviously something going on in the psyche that I yet to fully understand, let alone appreciate.
And what does back to the Democrats, since you've been there, what does a party for our listeners start to do after a midterm like this in terms, I know it's early, but preparing for 2020? What are some steps we should expect to see in the coming months?
Well, it's never too early. And I think that, you know, hopefully after a good night's sleep, it probably wasn't last night, but maybe it will be tonight. Leaders of the party are going to regroup and start to map out a strategy for how to continue this message of inclusion and opportunity and develop deep roots across the country that will help persuade people that they should invest in our democracy. Pouring of folks who participated in this midterms was certainly higher than in prior midterms, but not nearly what it should be. In the last presidential election, 43% of eligible voters didn't vote. 1 in 5 registered voters didn't vote. We have to change those numbers dramatically. And I think that work begins on the ground. I think it begins with neighbors talking to neighbors. I think it begins with parents taking their children with them to the polls so that they get used to the habit of voting. Evidence shows that people who vote when they're first eligible become or are more likely to become lifetime voters. I think a lot of the work that my organization that I'm a part of, When We All Vote, is designed to do in a nonpartisan way is to change the culture around voting and increase the appreciation that our democracy, if it's to be of the people, by the people, for the people, requires engagement by the people, and the most basic responsibility of citizenship is voting. And all too often, that doesn't happen. And I am particularly interested in capturing the hearts and minds of young people who will be hopefully those lifelong voters. And unfortunately, many of them are shunning institutions of all kinds, including government. And it's our job as the adults to communicate to them how important it is for them to feel an ownership in our government. It's only going to be as good as we the people demand that it be. And if we don't hold our elected officials accountable, if we don't vote, if we don't show up at public meetings and write letters and express ourselves to those in office, then that space will certainly be occupied by special interest groups and the minority. And so the way that the majority of the population makes a democracy is by definition showing up and voting.
How did When We All Vote, can you tell us a little bit more about it and how it started, what you're doing?
So I think over the course of the last few election cycles, Michelle Obama, has an alum of Princeton, has been increasingly concerned about this cultural phenomenon I just described. And so over the summer, she pitched to several of us this thought of creating a nonpartisan effort that really took the long view, not just about this midterm election, but more importantly, generations to come, of how could we change the culture. And so she asked people like Tom Hanks and Lin-Manuel Miranda and Janelle Monáe and Faith Hill and Chris Paul, an eclectic group of people with big footprints in terms of followings, to join her and create this new entity that would work in partnership with many of the existing nonpartisan entities around the country to change the culture around voting. And so we tried to make it cool again to vote. And we I think it made a difference, but our work is just beginning. And so one of our tasks going forward is to figure out what's our strategy between now and the next election to build on the progress that we made. And we have our team right now looking at election returns to figure out you know, what worked and what didn't, and we will do focus groups and try to develop a toolkit that increases voter turnout in a nonpartisan way. And, you know, there were those who said, well, you know, how is anything that you all do going to be viewed other than as a democratic tool? And we could have set up a democratic tool, and we, by design, set up a 501c3, because our view is that when we all vote, regardless of ideology, regardless of party, our democracy is stronger. And so that's our goal, is to strengthen our democracy through voter participation.
So we talked about Trump's hold on Republican voters. There's two parts to that. There's loyalty to party, which seems to play such a central role in politics. And then there's leadership, where leaders set the tone. And I was going to ask you about leaders for 2020, but I think I don't want to ask that. I think I'm really interested in your role in the report on women and girls that you led earlier during the Obama administration. And I want to link that up to a big thing we saw this year. Women candidates, over 100 women winning office in the House. More women, a record number of female candidates. So if we're thinking about either the content or tone of politics in the next 2 years, are there people who you see, maybe fresh faces or maybe more experienced faces, are there people you see who are really going to set the agenda and show what politics either is going to be like or can be like in the next 2 years?
Well, first of all, let me say this to you, Sam. In the 8 years I spent in Washington, I am convinced of a few things. One of them is that better decisions would have been made in Congress if there were more women at the table. I'm very uncomfortable, for example, with the fact that Leader McConnell created a committee to study the Affordable Care Act and ways of repealing it, and there wasn't a single woman on that committee. That's a problem for me, given that so much of the Affordable Care Act pertains to women's health. I want somebody who appreciates what it's like to have a woman's body in the decision-making process. I was troubled that the Judiciary Committee that decided important issues such as who has the privilege of serving on our Supreme Court didn't have a single woman Republican assigned to that committee.
You think Amy Coney Barrett would be on the Supreme Court if there were more women on that committee?
I can't imagine what they would have done. I just know that I believe diversity is a strength. And I believe when half of the population is comprised of women, we should have equal representation. I believe that it is a imperative in terms of governing, and I also think it's an imperative in terms of business. And so, you know, rather than identify individual candidates, of which there are a embarrassment of riches, I think, women who are now in office, women who are actively involved in campaigns, I think that the tone will be different with more women at the table. I have just after, you know, 25 years in both the private and the public sector, I can tell you that the organizations that had a good representation of women, I think, made healthier, more informed decisions. And I think that the next 2 years will bear that out.
Can you think of legislative areas, specific issues, whether in healthcare or elsewhere, where Democrats having House control will move the ball forward on something that can actually become law?
Well,
through appropriations or elsewhere?
We will not be able to accomplish the passage of laws without control of the Senate. What we can do is keep bad things from happening. So repealing the Affordable Care Act, for example, I think will be much tougher with a Democratic-controlled Senate. I think that my hope would be, and the fact that President Trump called Leader Pelosi last night is a small indication, that there would be a willingness to work with the House and the Senate to try to find common ground. And I'll give you one, which we spent a great deal of time on when I was chair of the White House Council of Women and Girls, and that's a basket of issues that I call working family issues. And you mentioned it, Julian, in the introduction. So equal pay. The first bill President Obama signed was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. And that was an important step to removing barriers for women to bring lawsuits when they're being discriminated against on the basis of pay. But still, far too many employers retaliate against workers who share pay. We had a bill called the Paycheck Fairness Act that would prohibit employers from doing that. And President Obama, when that bill failed, signed an executive order prohibiting federal contractors from doing that. Paid leave. We're the only developed country in the world, only one that doesn't have a national paid leave policy. We should have one. That's something that the Trump administration has touted. Well, I think they would find a very willing partner in the House to try to pass that kind of a bill. Workplace flexibility, that's something that can happen at the state and local level with private businesses. Working families who are trying to balance the needs of their families and the responsibilities of work need to have flexibility right now, and technology makes that a lot more possible. Raising the minimum wage, something else that would help working families. So there is a body of work that I think that women will care deeply about, and fortunately, increasingly, men recognize that it isn't just the nice thing to do for women. It's important for working families. 40% of working moms are either the primary or sole breadwinner in their family. A woman's contribution to the family income is more important than ever. And so I think that that's a basket of issues where I would like to see some progress. And at another extreme, something like infrastructure that has traditionally enjoyed bipartisan support that would immediately create jobs, which would be good for the economy and good for working families, is another area where I think there is opportunity for agreement if people together stop putting their short-term political interests ahead of what's good for the economy and good for our country.
I'm going to get into the weeds for just a second here and think about all these topics that you just discussed, priorities that you listed that could attract broad interest. In terms of actually getting legislation through, strikes me that the way through is, you know, I'm sorry to be really in the weeds here, the appropriations process. Which of these things could you imagine getting through that little tiny escape hatch in the gridlock that we're probably still going to have in January?
Well, that's a good question.
Because minimum wage seems like kind of a hard lift at the federal level until there's a more sympathetic Senate.
Well, and the president could change that. I mean, one of the facts that we shouldn't ignore in this last election is that what President Trump wants from his party, he gets. And so if he were to exercise leadership, and if he were to say, as his daughter has encouraged him to do, working in the White House, this is important and we should do it, then the Senate would do it. And I think what's clear is that he has a mandate from his Republicans in the Senate. They're terrified of him. They rely upon him to come and campaign for them. And so I think he could be quite compelling to move the Senate to do the right thing. So I don't actually think that the Senate is an independent body. They've demonstrated they haven't been. And now they're even more beholden, those in the Republican Party, to President Trump. So what he says, he will get from them.
Can healthcare stuff get into the appropriations?
Well, I don't think that the Republicans can repeal the Affordable Care Act.
No, I mean like positive steps.
Well,
by the House.
I think it unlikely. I would defer to, look, I hope some very creative minds in the House are trying to think that through right this minute. I'm more worried about holding on to what we have than trying to be as ambitious as to put forth a new agenda. But I will tell you, there's some very bright people in the House, in the Democratic Party, who are now in positions of leadership. And I trust that they will be looking at both, not just keeping bad things from happening, but trying to push forth an agenda that even if it doesn't pass in the short term, that will enable Americans to see what the Democratic Party stands for and why it is in their self-interest to support that party.
First, do no harm.
Do no harm.
Do you think that this is more from the perspective of someone who's been in the White House? What's your assessment? This is a question we talk about all the time, of the kind of damage that might be done to the institution of the presidency as a result of the way it's being governed and used right now. Are you someone, you're very optimistic, so I sense what you'll say, but do you think there will be long-term consequences to the way in which President Trump has used his office that are difficult to repair, even if you have a totally different kind of administration in 2020 or 2024?
I think he has done long-term damage to our country, both in terms of his tone and rhetoric, his kind of, as well as the laws that he has proposed and the executive orders and regulations that he's passed, many of which repeal much of the progress that was made for our country under President Obama. I mean, it's interesting when you think about the democracy. We know that the foundation of our democracy is the Constitution and that there are laws at the federal, state, and local level that build upon that and provide, as I call it, kind of an outer framework that we can all rely in a hopefully in an open and transparent way. But then there's a buffer zone, and that buffer zone is social norms. And it is as important to the fabric of our democracy as the laws that protect us. And when we begin to erode those social norms, it creates instability. And people don't know what to expect. If you talk to business, the single most important thing to them is certainty. And I think most Americans feel that way too. They want predictability and certainty. And right now, let's face it, by design, we have an erratic leader. He thrives in that erraticism. And I think that that is potentially quite destructive to that fabric I described. Now, there may be some who think, well, look, let's shake things up and let's try it differently. But I think we have to be, I think that it's important for leaders to be judicious and recognize that their words matter, that they could carry some unintended consequences. I think the kind of the rhetoric that stokes emotions that turn anger into violence is something that we should guard against if we are in positions of persuasion, appealing to the best in us rather than our more base instincts, I think is important. And the longer that continues, there is an erosion that becomes difficult, not just domestically, but internationally. I mean, all of our allies don't know what to think. They, you know, they shake their heads and they see the president cozying up more to dictators than to democracies. And it's confusing and it's unsettling, and not just for face value, but so many of the challenges that we have today are global in nature. We are inextricably linked together in ways that we never were a decade or certainly a generation ago. And the problems that we have require large-scale cooperation. And for that reason, it's important that the President of the United States be perceived around the world as somebody who is honest and straightforward and clear and deliberate and a sober thinker and transparent. And if they think that that's not the case, first of all, it gives them permission to behave poorly. Because in a sense, the United States has always been that beacon of hope. And so if our leader is exhibiting characteristics that are inconsistent with the leader of the most important democracy in the world, well, then what message does that send to other people about the behavior that they should comport? We're trying to convince people to follow our path in democracy, which relies on these important social norms. And by changing our behavior, we give a blank slate. And then the final point was I had started to make, which is that if you take our effort to keep Iran from developing nuclear weapons, for example, the U.S. imposing sanctions alone doesn't get the job done. What got the job done was when the United States paired up with every other major world leader and reached an agreement that couldn't have brought Iran to the table unless you had China and Russia and Great Britain and France and Germany and the EU all working together, and then India, that wasn't even a party to agreement, imposing sanctions at cost to them. That happens when you have the moral authority to persuade. And I don't think intimidation is the best tool for that. I believe that there is an important role for diplomacy and building relationships that do not make us weak. They actually give us broader reach and make us strong.
What's really become apparent, I think, for many people follow politics a little or a lot, is how much of the presidency relies on norms or decisions that the individual makes. I think at least when I teach students about American political history, there's an assumption that the White House is this huge machine, that there are rules, there are bureaucracies, there are staffers, as there are, surrounding a president every moment. But what's been amazing to see, disturbing, amazing, whatever word you want to do, is the way President Trump has exposed. If a president wants to do something, wants to break a norm, it isn't that hard. I mean, it's been an internal check.
Exactly. It is. You're completely right. There is an internal check there that is designed to signal stability and transparency and process. The word process makes some people just glaze over, Julian, but I will tell you that the reason why the Obama White House had such strict processes that were adhered to is that they all were designed to ensure that when President Obama made a decision, it was fully informed. Ultimately, there's only one decision maker, but it was our job as his staff to consult broadly, to reach out to a range of stakeholders, to look at the evidence, to study past practices, give him the results of our research in a format that he could easily digest, ask questions, push back, and make an informed decision. And when people think that that's in place, it gives them confidence in the stability of government. And when that isn't in place, it looks erratic because it is.
I wanted to maybe turn to things that are a little bit less policy oriented. We're getting close to the end of time here. I'm curious, as an insider, you have to really engage in message discipline, and you have to really make sure that you focus on the big ideas and so on. But I wanted to ask something kind of different. A few years ago, while you were still working in the administration, you made a cameo on a television program on The Good Wife. Was it a lot of work to focus on exactly what you wanted to say? It was just a short cameo. So on the one hand, was it fun? On the other hand, was it very controlled?
So much fun. I had a ball that day. The team that produced the show, from the producers to the writers to the actors to the cameramen, everyone was just so incredibly welcoming to me. It was something I'd never done before. And I agreed to go on if I could talk about something that was important to me. And the message that day was to try to convince Alicia Flores to run for office. And so I thought it was a nice way for me to make a cameo appearance, which they had been anxious for me to do, but deliver an important message. And so it was totally scripted because they have it timed for television. And so once we agreed on what the lines were, I had to memorize those lines, and there was no, you know, opportunity for spontaneity that day at all. And I remember the night before trying to memorize lines, which I hadn't done since I was in my third grade play. So it was fun. It was very cool. I enjoyed it. And I will tell you, it's a good example of how it's important to communicate. I mean, I did a lot of press from the North Lawn of the White House and, you know, major television shows. I will say, as I've traveled around the country, more people saw me on The Good Wife than ever saw me on Meet the Press.
And now that you're out of that spotlight and you're under other spotlights with your nonprofit work and with other work, now do you get to have more fun now? Do you still see the Obamas? Like, what kinds of things
sure,
are happening now?
I see
now?
Them all the time. I mean, they're two of my dearest friends. I'm helping him with his foundation, so I office with them in Washington. I'm on the road a lot, and they tease me for the fact that I don't really have to do what I'm doing, but I care about what I'm doing. So, you know, I'll send them notes from wherever I'm traveling, and they'll go, "What are you doing? You're working as hard as ever." And I think I'm at the stage of my life, Sam, where I have the luxury of being able to take a step back and say, I've had this extraordinary journey. It's been an adventure. It's been exhilarating and painful and every possible emotion in between. And at this stage, what do I really care about? And in the White House, we had to work on everything. Every single issue that came across his desk for 8 years as the longest serving advisor to any president came across mine. And now I have the ability to say, what really moves me and where do I want to spend my time and effort? And what I care about are civil rights, including gender, racial equality, equality for the LGBTQ community. I care about criminal justice reform, keeping people out of the system, making the system fairer, providing a path to reentry when they're released. I care about civic engagement. A big piece of the Obama Foundation is embedded in creating a platform for civic engagement and training the next generation. And I care about helping the next generation run for office. One of the reasons President Obama was reserved over the last couple of years is to make space for other leaders like the Andrews and Betos and Stacys to come forth. And that's important, too. And so I want to help that generation with now this reservoir of information and knowledge and expertise that I've accumulated over the years. I want to help them move the needle towards that more perfect union as well.
Great.
So we have a couple minutes, and I just wanted to finish on one question for you. I once had a student who came to the university eager to be part of politics and spend his life doing that. And then after the 2010 elections and everything that followed, he decided, I remember very clearly, Washington was dysfunctional, and he had a whole meeting with me where he said, I can't devote my life to this, and I want to do other things that will affect change and achieve the goals I want, but through tech and all other sectors. You have been in politics, you've been at the heart of this, and you've experienced the worst of it, not just the dysfunction, but the ugliness. What do you say to young people who have that bug, who have that passion, but are scared or they're dubious that Washington can make a difference? As a veteran, what do you say to them?
The only thing that changes Washington is if people are willing to roll up their sleeves and get involved. And the fact that we have so many first-timers now running for office, even those that didn't win, the fact that they were willing to join the arena and fight the fight is important. But I also think you have to feel the fire in your belly. And it isn't for everybody. And there's more than one way to serve. I've served half of my career in government and half in the private sector. And when I've been in the private sector, I've always had philanthropic and not-for-profit responsibilities that allowed me to continue to give back. And so I believe, for example, that the president, former president and first lady, can be extraordinarily impactful in this next chapter of their life outside of government. And so I think it's really a matter of figuring out, you know, what gives you fulfillment? What makes you feel terrific at the end of the day? Of all the frustrations that I felt in 8 years, there were so many moments of pure magic, moments where I saw the lives that we were able to improve, even save. We saw people at their most vulnerable after horrendous mass shootings or tornadoes and hurricanes, and we saw their humanity to one another. I would not have missed that bird's eye view of the essence of our nation, good, bad, and otherwise, for anything. But I recognize it's not for everyone. And so if it was too frustrating to that one student, you might say, well, go do something else for a bit, but help somebody who you think can get in there and reflect your values and your ideals. But do not give up on our government. It is a bedrock of our democracy. It is an institution that we cannot abandon, or we no longer have a democracy by definition.
And, you know, I didn't even get to ask you about this thing that Julie Alperin, I don't know how to say her last name, wrote about this women's office strategy, right? Mm-hmm. Like of, I was fascinated by, at your level, at the highest reaches of government, you got to play around with this office strategy where you're talking to each other and you say, you know, we're going to point out that somebody had this idea first, or we're going to support each other. How does that work? You're at the highest level and you still have to do that?
You don't get rid of your gender just because you're at the table. All of the baggage that people have from a lifetime, and women too. I mean, I'm writing a book, which I should have mentioned, but in my book, I talk about the context for all of that. And it was my observation that women's voices were fading and that they were kind of being muscled out by some of the, you know, testosterone in the room. President Obama never signaled that he didn't want to hear what they had to say, but they came to the table with their prior life experiences, as we all do.
So when it was brought up to him, he acknowledged it and he was okay.
Well, not only did he acknowledge it, he invited all the women to dinner and he said, let's talk about this and tell me what the problem is. And then the other thing he said to them, which I encourage other men to do, is he said, if you don't speak up when I'm not in the room and when I am in the room, then you're not doing your job. This isn't about you. This is about me making better decisions. And so I need you to speak up. Right. And it was almost like, oh, okay. And they felt empowered. He empowered them to really get in there and fight. So the strategies were not as deliberate and calculated as maybe it sounded, but more like at the end of this dinner, he said, if you all ever start to feel as though your voices aren't being heard again, tell Valerie and we'll get back together. And so I started having regular dinners with the women, senior women in the White House, and we expanded it to the cabinet as well. And at the end of each dinner, I would say, well, does anybody need to go back and see the president? And everybody's like, no, we're fine. We're fine. We're good now. And part of why I think we became good is that we formed a bond with each other. And so many of us, if you think about the White House, it's a startup operation. None of us had ever worked together in the White House together. Many of us had never worked together or didn't even know each other before day one. And so you're putting a team together. It takes a minute to develop confidence in one another, learn each other's strengths and weaknesses, learn to trust one another. And I think what happened is that the cohort of women really started to bond with one another. And then that made going into a meeting not so terrifying.
That's wonderful.
Because you looked around the room and you knew the people who were there. Right. And in time, obviously, we developed relationships with the guys as well. But it wasn't easy in the beginning. And President Obama deserves a credit for bringing us together and saying, we have to solve this problem because the culture I want to create is one where every voice, no matter how soft, is respected and heard.
I have to say, watching that was from news reports, just hearing about it was amazing.
It was good. I was really proud of how he handled it.
Right.
Because you could just say, well, you know, if you can't stand the heat, you know, get out. And he had too much talent around that table to risk losing them.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
That's good.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, I think we'll end it on that terrific thought. And again, our guest was Valerie Jarrett, former senior advisor to President Barack Obama, former chair of the White House Council on Women and Girls, currently a senior advisor to the Obama Foundation, and president of a really important organization, When We All Vote, which is a nonprofit focused on the crucial issue, whether you're Democrat or Republican, of voter registration and making sure our democracy works. So thanks again for joining our show.
Thank you so much, Julian and Sam. I enjoyed being with you guys.
Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.